Our gospel text appears in the gospel according to St. John, the 8th chapter. It starts with verse 31. We might preface our consideration of the text, verses 31 to 36, with some observations regarding chapter 8 generally. I mean, here's Jesus in the face of both friends and foes, having a lot to say, much to say, for the sake of both his friends and his foes, regarding issues that have been developing and are coming to a bit of a climax here in chapter 8. As early as chapter 5, the opposition wants to kill Jesus. It's especially in chapter 8 that so many of the issues that Jesus has been having over the emerging conflict that he's been experiencing with both his foes and his friends actually kind of, all this comes to a climax in chapter 8. The heavenly Jesus, who comes in the guise of earthly flesh, is having trouble both with foes and with friends, helping them understand his ultimate purpose, even his ultimate person. So early in chapter 8, with verses 14 and 15, for example, he is motivated to say, "I know where I have come from and where I am going, but you do not know where I am coming from or where I am going." And again, he's speaking to both his foes and his friends in all of this. The difficulty is this one, then. The heavenly Jesus is just not being recognized even by his friends in complete terms, that is. Who he really is, why he's really here, and where he's really going with any of this is lost, not just on the opposition, but even on his followers. So, of course, when he goes the way of the cross, this will create a huge bit of commotion for his followers. His followers will fail to comprehend Jesus' person and purpose, especially when it's time for the cross. Verse 19, "You neither know me nor my Father." Verse 23, "You are from below, I am from above. You are of this world, I am not of this world." Much of this continues to be lost, even on the followers, until it comes time for Jesus to rise from the dead. So and Jesus knows that it's going to go this way. This is why he refrains from entrusting himself to the masses in this narrative as early as chapter two, with the temple cleansing episode. The masses are quite excited and inclined to receives this Jesus early on, but Jesus does not entrust himself to this early reception of him. He knows what's in the heart of man. He knows how this is going to go later on. When will they actually begin to figure any of these things out? Verse 28, when you lift up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am. With all this in mind, I think we're in a stronger position to read with due attention to nice things, verses 31 to 36. Verse 31 then begins with these words, "Elegant un ha Jesus." Jesus began to speak. The verb form here, "elegant," is an imperfect. It just might be inceptive. In response to Jesus' words, you would think that many would be just kind of wondering what in the world he means by any of this and wouldn't know what to make of Jesus' words. But in fact, verse 30 indicates that many actually believed in him on account of his words. This should not be taken to mean, though, that they're necessarily comprehending everything that he's talking about. Seeing, hearing, understanding, believing, trusting that Jesus is what he says that he is one thing. Comprehending what he's been talking about might appropriately be viewed as a separate issue. they're believing in him at this point, but they still don't know who he really is or where he's going. Jesus therefore says, especially to those who are now believing in him, pros tous pepis ducotes auto judaeus. So there are Jews now who have, in the face of all of this, believed in him. Pros tous, followed by the substantival use of the participle of pistuo, its perfect, so past act, present, enduring result. In the present circumstance of Jesus' engagement of the Jews, these have believed and are now believing on him or in him. He says to these especially, on humes menate, or menate, if you abide in my word, en to loco to emo. These are familiar words, but we should be sure to contextualize this statement of Jesus. If you abide in my word, which you're not currently understanding, you are truly my disciples, alethos matetai mu este. You will be this, and you will know, verse 32, kai gnosis the ten aletheon, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free, or will free you, kai he aletheia, eleutherose himas. This is an intriguing suggestion coming from Jesus at this point in the narrative. Not surprisingly, those in his presence who have now, in fact, believed in him will immediately take issue with this statement. They will fail to comprehend its significance. They will focus on a set of issues not uncommon for these persons, as even with these persons who are happening to believe in Jesus. The heavenly is coming in the guise of the earthly. The earthly, all too typically in this narrative, when in the presence of the Jesus of the Gospel of John, who is both heavenly and earthly, will often be challenged to reckon with this heavenly Jesus speaking their language. When they do that, they will often tend to understand, as did Nicodemus before, understand the heavenly intention of Jesus in entirely kind of regular and everyday and earthly terms. So if Jesus is here speaking with reference to the promise of persons belonging to Jesus as in terms of freedom, they're going to go quickly to the issue of their everyday experience, and especially their earthly experience of freedom or the lack thereof, and they're going to somewhat predictably, I would suggest, fail to comprehend the greater or more comprehensive intention of Jesus in speaking with reference to freedom. So they do that in verses 33 and following. They answered him, apa kritheson pros auton. Freedom? What do you mean, freedom? We are the seed of Abraham, sperma Abraham esmen, and have not rendered a service to anyone, kai udene dedulukamen popate, at any time. So whether we should be kind of laughing at them or not is kind of an interesting question. They're not being absurd, though. These are not unintelligent people. They're not being stupid. In their own experience, in their own present experience, as Jewish persons living under Rome, living under Herod, they have been afforded a fairly significant form of freedom, a rather significant opportunity to operate and to live according to their own traditions, according to their own customs. They are not, in fact, in slavery to anyone exactly at the present time. But there is a certain, you know, while we should perhaps first appreciate that they're not being stupid about anything, at the same time, they are speaking in a particular context, not without its irony. There is a current overlord. They do happen to be living under others, and those others are not exactly the kind of leaders that the Jews would have normally preferred or otherwise enjoyed. It's not an especially good time for Israel. That being said, they're not entirely incorrect in suggesting that they that they're not currently, you know, having to serve as slaves any master. So you know, they're quick to say, with reference to their earthly existence, that which is born of the flesh is flesh. So they're just kind of dealing with, you know, their everyday issues as persons born of the flesh. I mean, they're objecting to the suggestion that they're in need of emancipation from anything exactly. We are the seed of Abraham. We are free persons. We get to live our lives largely in terms of, you know, our desire to follow our own customs. What do you mean you're going to set us free? What exactly are you talking about? Now, you know, let's see. We've dealt then with the first part of verse 33. I don't think we've looked at the last question in verse 33. Posu leges hote eleutheroi genesesthe. How are you saying that you will be made or become free? Well, Jesus will try to help them understand his intention for speaking with reference to freedom. You know, he won't go to their issues, though, exactly. This is the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. This is how the Lamb accomplishes the purposes of God in addressing the problem of sin. They're not thinking of the problem of sin. They are probably thinking that they would like to be emancipated from the influence and the control of Rome. There's evidence elsewhere in the narrative that the Jews are looking to Jesus to be this sort of a prophet like Moses and this sort of a king. So in chapter 6, they want to make him king, but Jesus doesn't entrust himself to their to their intentions or to their motivations. It's not that these other issues are absent. They're likely to be very much a part of the motivated response of the Jews in responding now to Jesus' reference to the issue of freedom. But again, they're just not comprehending the heavenly person or person or purpose of this Jesus in referring to the issue of freedom. That motivates him to try to inform their current understanding of any of these issues, first with reference, or now with reference especially to the issue of sin and what sin does to the human person. So verse 34, apakrite autois ha Jesus, Jesus answered them, amen, amen, truly, truly, lego human, I am saying to you, hati. Yeah, Hati introduces the clause of direct discourse. Pas hoi ha poi on. Everyone who, well, does sin or, you know, performs an act of sin or even lives, you know, a life characterized by sin. Ha poi on tain hamartian. Doulos estin is a slave, tais hamartias, of sin. Let's get to a very basic issue and point here, suggests Jesus. If we're going to talk about slavery and freedom, it needs to be appreciated that sin itself has to become, you know, a formative question and issue. If Jesus is to be who he means to be, if Jesus, you know, is in fact the heavenly one now come in the guise of earthly flesh, he's come not just for the sake of, you know, the immediate issues of the Jews in their everyday experience with Rome, he's come especially for the sake of dealing with the foundational issue and problem of sin itself. He's come to deal with this problem especially. It's not likely that they're thinking of his person and his purpose in these terms exactly right now. So this is what he directs their attention to. Verse 35, ha de doulos ou mene, the slave does not abide ente oikea in the house, there's an interesting comment, in the age which is to come, eston iona, rather, ha huios, the son, abides in the age which is to come, eston iona. He invokes the issue of household. He suggests to these Jews that belonging to the household of God doesn't happen if you're a slave. It only happens if you're a son. It only happens if you're one of the householder's children. He's going this way, first with the issue of sin, then with the issue of household, because now he wants them to understand what it truly means to be a child of Abraham, a child of God, one of the seed, right? One of the descendants. You got to be connected with the Son, with his person and his purpose. It's all got to be located and centered in the person of Jesus. Just being a child of Abraham will, in the end, not be sufficient. You got to belong to this Jesus. It's necessary to embrace this Jesus and go with him, even when you're not necessarily understanding who he ultimately is or what his ultimate purpose is. You must embrace this Jesus and go with him. That's the challenge of Jesus here. In order to belong to the household, you must belong to the Son. Jesus is the heavenly Son. The Son abides in the age which is to come. Verse 36, if therefore, e'an un, the Son frees you, ha huias humas eleutherose, you will indeed be free, ontos eleutheroi esesta. Well, it's chapter 8, it's not chapter 19. When chapter 19 transpires, when the events and circumstances of the passion and the resurrection of Jesus transpire, then Jesus' person will again his person and his ultimate purpose for coming as the heavenly Son will be the featured issues of those concluding chapters of the narrative, and these things will be resolved. Finally, someone will say at the close of chapter 20, my Lord and my God, in response to this Jesus finally comprehending these ultimate and final things. But here in chapter 8, in spite of all of this, in spite of Jesus' actions, his deeds, and his words, much of this continues to be lost on them. So the reader here in chapter 8 is struck by the irony of a Jesus who has come for this as the heavenly Son for the sake of a heavenly purpose, he's speaking consistently with reference to that, you know, all-important significance of his person and his purpose. But as he goes, the human persons in the narrative are just continue to struggle with all of this as they attempt to reckon with this Jesus, who continues to be a bit of an enigmatic, you know, kind of messiah to them. It's not going to go well with the rest of the story, is what we're suggesting here in kind of wrapping up a little bit. To us, you know, the person and the attention of Jesus is fairly plain and clear. To them, it was not. By the time you get to the end of chapter 8, the words of this Jesus are provoking so many of the same people now to desire to stone him. It goes back and forth this way with Jesus in the Gospel of John. You know, a reception, but then a subsequent rejection. It's just kind of the ebb and flow of the telling of the story. They're receiving him, then they're not receiving him. Sometimes it's not clear, especially in chapter 8, it tends to be kind of consistently unclear who it is exactly that Jesus is talking to, friend or foe, and what it is that the friends or the foes are doing with the words of Jesus. They tend to consistently like what they're seeing in this Jesus, but then when it comes to the challenge of dealing with Jesus' message, with his word, with his words, this is at the same time consistently making it difficult for even the people who have been wanting to believe in him and to remain, to abide with him, to in fact continue to do that. He's going to keep challenging them with his words. It's just an important and telling aspect of the narrative of this gospel in particular, that we notice that his words are consistently creating this sort of a conflict even for the followers. That conflict's not going to go away. That conflict's going to intensify. That conflict is going to especially become acute when Jesus makes it plain to all that he's not going to shirk the mission of the cross and the accomplishment of the purposes of God. By the time he goes to the cross, or when he goes to the cross, then he will go to the cross alone, because until Jesus is risen from the dead, and there's a post Easter opportunity for the followers of Jesus to reckon not just with the seeing of him, but also the hearing of him. They will be in a position to ultimately understand either his person or his purpose. This is so much a part of the struggle of persons in the story, so much a part of the irony of the telling of the story. It's the tragic story of the failure of all to comprehend the person and the heavenly purpose of the Son of God in coming and accomplishing the purposes of God with the offering of this story. It's chapter 8. It's telling at the end of chapter 8 that they just want to kill him on account of the words. I'm searching for a way to, kind of draw this to a close. These are some of the telling themes of the narrative. These are some of the things that continue to trouble us all as Christian persons in a world today where we struggle with a Jesus whose person and purposes in our lives are not always clear. I think, in the latter part of the first century for John and his contemporaries, in our world, in our day too, we have the opportunity to be encouraged by this telling of a tragic story, not because of the tragedy, but because of the ultimate accomplishment of this Jesus in the face of all of that trouble. And our encouragement especially comes in our own day in the face of similar struggles, seeing but not seeing, embracing but not always fully comprehending. Ours is the knowledge of a Jesus who has accomplished all things for us. We are encouraged to abide, even in the midst of our current struggle, with this Jesus and his word, whether we fully comprehend it or not, because we know certain things that are, established for us, and we know that the day will come when Jesus provides us with, a final resolution to all of these troubles with his second coming, with the judgment of the living and the dead, and our opportunity to see ourselves as his brethren, as we see him just as he is in the New Jerusalem. So, in preaching and teaching from this gospel, I think these become the opportunities to focus on an important gospel that's centered in the telling of the story. So, thanks. We'll kind of stop with that.
Glenn Thomas.
Let me just stop it by pressing. Yeah.